Welcome to the Max Moo Podcast, a podcast about New York City theater. This is Lindsay Behrens. I'm the founder of Max Moo. We had so much to say on this episode that I had to split it in half. This is the first half, and the second half will come out later this week. As always, all of the shows and playwrights we talk about are listed on maxmoo.com. Just click on podcasts. Enjoy the show. All right, shall we just jump into introductions?
Sure.
Okay, Nicole, why don't you start?
Hi, this is Nicole. I write about theater at Mildly Bitter's Musings and The Craptacular.
Good. Mike?
Hi, I'm Mike Liu. I'm a playwright, and I am a co-director of the Mayu Writers Lab, which is the largest collective of Asian American playwrights in the history of recorded time.
Awesome. And I'm Lindsay. I'm the founder of Max Moo, a website that makes recommendations beyond Broadway. So what we were planning to talk about today is some of our favorite playwrights who are also playwrights of color, and also some of the upcoming productions by playwrights of color. And the reason we're talking about this in part is because last year's best of lists that were announced by the major publications had a shocking and absolute absence of playwrights of color represented by on them. And Mike, you noted this on Twitter and started a hashtag look harder, as in look harder for more diverse work by diverse people.
Yeah, it was kind of a disappointment. Time Magazine, New York Magazine, and both of the New York Times Best Of lists for 2013 didn't have any productions by writers of color. And then also the 2014 preview for New York Times, which they were pretty limited on their space. But nonetheless, you know, I think that there's a lot of options out there. There was a lot of really strong work last year, especially. And so it seemed like kind of a glaring omission. And I wanted to bring more exposure to some of the great productions that were out there last year that some of the critics might have missed.
And so we thought what we would do is help people look harder and point out some of the playwrights that are working today that we really enjoy, who are playwrights of color, and also upcoming productions in here in New York City, principally. I assume we limited our search to New York City. We had no rules for the things we could bring today to talk about, except that I did exclude some people from the discussion because we'd already talked about them. So we're not talking about basically any of the shows that are coming to the public for the second half of their season. So A Second Chance by Ted Chen and Father Comes Home from the Wars by Susan Laurie Parks and Antony and Cleopatra by Terrell Avon McCraney. And also Kung Fu by David Henry Hwang. And then I was thinking, I don't think I told you guys this, but then I was thinking, well, we don't really need to talk about A Raisin in the Sun by Lorraine Hansberry on Broadway because they have like a multi-million dollar budget to market their production.
They don't need us?
And
is that what
super
you're saying?
Movie stars. So I'm not saying we can't talk about any of those. And if you plan to, that's totally fine. But we have kind of talked about those shows.
If we're looking harder, there's other stuff to talk about.
Yeah, and so I was thinking we could try to sort of expand the people and the shows that we were talking about. But that's not an absolute rule. And feel free to raise them if you would like. So, Nicole, would you like to get us started?
Sure. As usual, I somehow always find the British imported production to talk about because that's my thing. So the first piece I wanted to talk about that's an upcoming production is the play Red Velvet, which is going to be at St. Anne's Warehouse starting in late March, going into April. It's written by a former actress who this is her first play, Lolita Chakrabarty. And it stars Adrian Lester, who happens to also be her husband. And it's all about Black American actor Ira Aldridge, who in the 1830s moved from America to England as an actor and pursued his craft throughout the regions of England. And then in 1833, when Edmund Kean, who was like the big Brad Pitt of his day, fell ill and I think actually died playing Othello, Aldridge steps in and replaces him, and he was the first Black actor to actually play Othello in the Covent Garden and the London's West End. And so this was sort of a story that not a lot of people knew about, and Lester himself didn't know a lot about it. And so it kind of came up in a talk that he was participating in. And so Lolita Chakrabarty went off and wrote this play, which was presented at the Tricycle Theater in London. And then, interestingly enough, Lester played it at the Tricycle. He then went to the National Theater to play Othello and has gone back to now return to Red Velvet to play Ira Aldridge, who plays Othello within the play Red Velvet. So that's definitely one of the pieces that I'm looking forward to.
Did you say that's at St. Anne's already?
It is, yeah.
Okay. And they sent out this totally hysterical email saying, like, this is sold out. You get your tickets now. And I completely panicked. But what they were saying was that it had sold out in London and that tickets were now on sale here in the U.S. So it's right. not sold out yet. But I think the anticipation is that this is going to be an excellent production that is going to be very popular. So you better get your tickets now.
Yeah, and I think it's Adrian Lester has been in New York a number of times in various plays, but I think it's actually been a while from the last time I can recall him coming to town with something. And I think the Tricycle Theater where it's playing in London, where they've actually done a second after he left Othello at the National, he's gone back to play it again at the Tricycle because it had such a successful first run. So they're doing actually a second run, which is again sold out. I mean, I'm assuming it's a smaller house, but I think it's something very exciting to, you know, see here a story we haven't really heard before, and also an opportunity to see Adrian Lester. Although he's recently written an op-ed in The Guardian about the challenges of portraying Ira Aldridge's performance in the 1830s as Othello, because of the style of acting that he has to, sort of the historically accurate style of acting, which is very unusual for us today. So there's a lot to sort of unpack in there, both sort of socioculturally and artistically, that I think might be really intriguing.
Definitely. Cool. Mike?
I'll start off with just what's going on at home at Mayi Theater. Right now, we have a children's theater production by Lloyd Suh, who's just has this amazing sort of comedic talent. He had previously done a play called American Hwangup at Mayi that was about a 50-year-old Korean's fractured family between sort of his abandoned family in America and kind of the expectations back home being a Korean immigrant. And now he is doing The Wong Kids in The Secret of the Space Chupacabra Go. which is...
You had me at Chupacabra.
Yeah.
Which definitely is a winner in the title category, for sure.
So that's... I don't know what it's about yet. I just know that he's got, like, incredible sort of comedic chops, and he's doing this thing that started out in Minneapolis as a commission with a children's theater company, and Mayi's never done a children's play before. I think that the sweet spot's kind of, like, around 8 years old or sort of up to... maybe like middle school. I'm going to try out taking my niece and nephew that are 5 and 3 and see if they get scared or, run from the theater. We'll see how low
or won't sit still long enough.
Yeah, we'll see how low it goes. But I'm excited about that. And then also the Writers Lab as a group is doing a benefit for the Philippines on February 17th at Playwrights Horizons. They've been very generous to let us be on the stage of Sarah Rolls' play for a night. And we're doing a series of plays that are based on proverbs in Tagalog that have been translated. And so it's called Words of Wisdom. The benefits will go towards buying new fishing boats for villagers that were affected by the typhoon.
Oh, that sounds great. Now, I didn't know actually that The Wong Kids is a children's show. That's, I don't know, interesting.
It's weird for us because Mayi, there's like no tenure on membership once you're in, and the output of our writers is like sometimes Asian-specific and sometimes not, and in this case it's like kid-specific, and so it's sort of like when you have a company of writers, like how do you follow their impulses, and in this case Lloyd's a recent father two times over, and he had this in him, and he had this... partnership with a theater that we were excited about working with. And so now, unlike subscription audiences where it's like you have people that can sort of year in, year out, like, oh, I kind of like this theater stuff, I'll go to them. Like, we now have to find a bunch of like families. And then my play earlier in the season was, I think it had like 100 something F-bombs. And so it's like in totally different audience. Right,
right. Your mailing list is totally useless.
Yeah.
Marketing challenges.
Yeah, I mean, outreach to different groups and, getting them while they're young.
Well, I think it sounds really cool. I don't have any kids handy, but I might go anyway.
Steal a couple. It's fine.
Damn it. My nieces and nephews all live in Utah.
I know. My niece is not close by, so.
Oh, well. All right. So the first play I wanted to talk about is by Marcus Gardley, who is a... Stop it.
What's so funny?
I think I talk about him on every episode.
He's awesome.
He is awesome. But he has a new show coming up called The Box that's being produced by the Foundry Theater.
Oh.
Yeah, who just did Good Person of Szechuan with Taylor Mack, who we also talk about on every episode.
It's not a bad thing.
No, but, you know, Marcus Gardley is just exploding and has, I don't know how this is even possible, but 3 world premieres basically going on simultaneously right now, one in Denver, one in Berkeley, and one in Chicago at Victory Gardens. Is that what that theater's called?
Yeah, it's Victory Gardens. I think it's going to be directed by the artistic director, Che Yu. I'm trying to find, I think I'd written it down somewhere, but I don't know where it is. So.
One in Chicago is called The Gospel of Loving Kindness.
Oh, yeah, there you go. It's in February, March.
Yep. And then the one that's in Berkeley is called The House...
That Will Not Stand.
The House That Will Not Stand, which is being produced in conjunction with Yale Rep, and then is going to the Yale Rep in the April-May timeframe, the exact same timeframe that his play is going to be produced by the Foundry Theater. So that's like 4 plays. I mean, how prolific can a single person be? I don't know. But I'm very excited about it. I think that this play, the new one, The Box, is about some experiences that he's had and that people he knows have had with police assault and imprisonment, and he has this amazing ability to talk about really serious issues by injecting a lot of humor into it, which I think makes them very approachable. And so this is apparently in the same vein that his other works have been in, and that will be in April and May, so I am really looking forward to that.
I think it makes sense about the fact that he has so many world premieres going, just because I know that I'd first met him several years ago at New Dramatists, and it was the kind of thing where like a lot of literary managers really knew him, but his plays take a really long gestation time, and people are struck by like the sort of social justice component and also the lyricism in his work, but it's like he takes a long time to sort of build it up, and so now like it makes sense that like there's all these projects, but there's also kind of this real groundswell of goodwill around his work, and I'm just really excited to see sort of nationally like all of these plays coming to fruition at the same time.
It's so fortunate that we have an actual playwright here to tell us what makes sense and what doesn't make sense instead of just wild speculation like we usually have. All right, cool. I'm glad to hear that. That's awesome. All right, Nicole.
Okay, the next play I wanted to talk about is The Happiest Song Plays Last, which is coming to Second Stage, running through February and March. It's the last piece of the Elliot cycle, or the Elliot trilogy, by Chiara Allegria Hudis. If I'm mispronouncing that, I apologize. I'm the queen of mispronouncing things. Directed by Ruben Santiago Hudson, and the first piece of the trilogy was Elliot, A Soldier's Fugue, which was on the shortlist for the Pulitzer, and then her second piece in this trilogy, Water by the Spoonful, won the Pulitzer, and so this is the third piece in that series. And I saw Water by the Spoonful last year at Second Stage, and I really liked it. And it's funny because just I in my review of it, the first thing I sort of pulled out was, you know, the minute she mentions a sofa covered in plastic, I am like, that is my grandmother's house. I know exactly who you're talking about. And it's that sort of immigrant community. And, you know, sort of cross-generational stuff that was really intriguing to me. And I think for Water by the Spoonful, the dynamic between the two characters, Yaz and Elliot, who are cousins, this is a continuation of that. So Elliot is a Gulf War veteran who's come home and is dealing with sort of the issues that have come out of his war service. And Yaz is getting a divorce and is a music professor and trying to sort of figure out her place in the world. And so it's a continuation of those two characters in the third piece. And what I didn't realize until I went back and sort of did a little bit more reading was that each of the pieces in the trilogy are based on a piece of music, which I wasn't aware of. Hudis's background, she has her degree from Yale in music. So the first one was relates to Bach. Water by the Spoonful had all of this stuff about Coltrane in it and American jazz. And then this piece, Happiest Song Plays Last, involves Puerto Rican folk music. So that's going to be sort of underlying everything within the play. So, you know, I'm very excited. I loved Armando Riesco in Water by the Spoonful. So I'm excited that he's going to be back in this next play.
I'm looking forward to that one too. I'm a member at Second Stage, so I'll be there.
I feel like I'm slightly giving a book report here.
What I think actually is great is that you, I mean, you know, like what to expect with a lot of these plays, because some of these plays that I'm excited about, it's just more like the person or like their body of work, but I don't actually, I mean, I feel like an ass being like, you should see this, but I don't know anything about it.
Except we do that all the time.
Basically the nature of our business. So. Okay.
I mean, fine. We kind of have to. You kind of just have to put that thing out there that you're like, you know what, guys? Maybe you haven't heard of this person, or you haven't heard of this theater company or this director or this actor. But you know what? Like, I've liked other things they've done, and I'm willing to go. Like, I sort of made this pledge to see, like, all of Steve Rosen's performances one year. Like, Janine Sirales. Like, I will go to any play that she's in, regardless of how much I like it or not. I mean, it doesn't matter, because sometimes you just kind of want to follow the artist you're interested in and see their work and see how it develops. And, you know, it's a risk for everybody, but you got to start somewhere.
Yeah, it's really the only thing you can intelligently base a decision on, right? I mean, either somebody else has seen something and told you that it's good, so it has good word of mouth, or you've seen something by a person involved in the production, and as a result, they've earned your artistic loyalty, and so you follow them wherever they go. And because you've seen something good by them in the past, you think, well, there's a greater likelihood that this is going to be good than me throwing a dart at the Time Out magazine.
It's possible. Yeah. I mean, certainly people can disappoint you. I mean, I feel like I could probably fill a notebook.
I mean, everybody can be perfect all the time. Unlike us, the people in this room.
Who get the answers right always. We, you know...
Okay, Mike.
Yeah, so one of the theater companies that I'm a member of is called Ensemble Studio Theater, and I started with them at Youngblood, and which is like a group for writers under 30, and now I'm like a member proper. And they have a program that's sponsored by the Sloan Foundation, where it's plays that are about the world of science, and have two plays coming up in the spring that are sort of under those auspices, but also... one of the issues kind of internally with a lot of theaters really is this issue of gender parity and sort of the dearth of plays by women. And so EST had made a commitment to try to really bump up the number of productions. And so two of them for this Sloan, Sloan program are going to be one by Carla Ching and one by Corey Thomas. Carla is, she was like a New York-based playwright for years, and then as soon as she moved to L.A., she got a production here, so she'll have to come back. But Fast Company started out as a Sloan commission about like game theory and sort of this family of degenerate gamblers and kind of like people sort of trying to put one over on each other within this family. And it had its premiere at South Coast Rep in L.A. So it was like, as soon as she got to L.A., it was like, here, have this production. And then EST said, hey, and also come back. And so she'll be coming back in the spring to work on that. When January Feels Like Summer is a play that Corey's had around for a little while. I actually saw it premiere in Pittsburgh, and it'll be coming back to EST now. It's a lot of things. There's like an intergendered character in it. There's like it takes place in New York City. It's like this unusual heat wave in the middle of the winter. So it's sort of about climate change and just kind of like strivers in New York and trying to get by. And it's like I'm not really doing it service because it's like such a beautiful sort of wide-reaching thing. But it's just worth checking out because also science. So you should check it out.
That's a spit take.
I wish you all could have seen that moment. But it's interesting. I mean, just the Sloan Foundation's commitment to that, because I know they do it for film as well, and just bringing that dialogue into the theater space and, you know, encouraging artists to use science as a, you know, whether it's a metaphor or part of the story is really intriguing. I feel like there's been a lot of climate change work that's been happening, but I'm always curious to see what other topics people approach.
Yeah, and I think that also it started out as a lot of like biopics, and now to sort of incorporate game theory or climate change into a play, as opposed to kind of like this is the
another
story
of biography of Marie Curie.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, like
she's a lady in science.
I think there was one. Yeah, that's the
one. We've got one.
Cool. Well, those sound great. Sorry to cut off the conversation right in the middle, but the episode was just too long to include in a single file. So that's the end of part one of the Look Harder episode. We would love to hear from you about this topic. What playwrights have you discovered in your endeavor to look harder for more diverse theater? You can find all of us on Twitter. Maximu is at M-A-X-A-M-O-O. Nicole is at Mildly Bitter. That's M-I-L-D-L-Y-B-I-T-T-E-R. Mike is at MikeLew4. That's M-I-K-E-L-E-W and the number 4. And I'm at Lindsay Behrens. L-I-N-D-S-A-Y-B-A-R-E-N-Z. See you in a couple of days with the second half of this episode.